Okay, Acts chapter 20, we're going to start reading verse 1. And then we're going to look at the first 17 verses. It is probably a good idea to have your maps with you when we read, because we are approaching a section where there will be a scene, a Christian community together, and then there will be some what we call a travel report. And in each travel report, you see traveling happening. So there's going to be four of them. And three scenes from here all the way to chapter 21. And so it's tricky once you when you're reading and not being able to keep up. So you want to keep that map in front of you, so just to get an idea and perspective. And if you don't like geography or like whatever, I'm just going to listen. That's fine too. You can study the geography later. Let's look at chapter 20. This title of this chapter is Encouraging and Strengthening Others and Worshiping on the Lord's Day. The theme you'll see in this chapter, the very first, is the encouragement that comes through the ministry of Paul. And you'll see it as we go through it. Chapter 20, verse 1. After the uproar was over, remember that, at Ephesus? Paul sent for the disciples, encouraged them, and after saying goodbye, departed to go to Macedonia. He's at Ephesus, right? If you look at your map, Ephesus is going to go to Macedonia. So here's your map. He's at Ephesus. He's going to go to Macedonia. This area geographically is huge, right? That's where Troas is at the corner there. Philippi is there. Thessalonica is there. Corinth. All right, so he wants to go from Ephesus to Macedonia. That's what his intent is. Departed to Macedonia, and we had passed through those areas. So he went there. He went through those areas. He's going to go to Macedonia. He's going to pass through these areas. He's going to go to Troas, Philippi, to Thessalonica. Okay? So he is he's going to go through those areas. Through those areas and exhorted them at length, he came to Greece. Now, the word Greece is a little tricky there because it really means that whole geographical area here. And basically, it's called Achaia. That's what it's in Greek. Well, what's Achaia? What's in Achaia? Corinth. So he's going to go there. All right? So he came to Greece or Corinth and stayed 3 months. When he was about to set sail for Syria, a plot was devised against him by the Jews, so a decision was made to go back through Macedonia. So his plan is to go back to Syria. Well, where is Syria? Down this way. Because he's going where? He's going to go to Jerusalem. So he's planning to go there, but what happens is there's a plot, right, to go back. And he says he's not going to go this way. He could have gone from here, right, and gone through sea all the way to Syria. He won't do that because there's a plot against him. And what does he do? So a decision was made to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy and Tychicus, and Trophimus from Asia. How about naming some of your kids that like that, huh? Or grandkids. These men went on ahead and waited for us in Troas. Now notice the form of the presentation. Now, what kind of presentation we see here? Is it a third voice now or no? Verse 5. These men went on ahead and waited for us, right? In Troas, but we sailed third person, right? It's a first person. Narration here, but we sailed away from Philippi after 3 days of unleavened bread. In 5 days, we reached them at Troas, where we spent 7 days. So who's joining the team there? Who's the author? Luke. He's joining where? Possibly in Philippi. They're going back to Philippi. He joins the team. Now he's narrating. We did this. So he's joining in this part here. So this is the first section we're going to look at. And Paul is going to revisit those areas that I just pointed out in the map for you. Where is he going? What is the purpose? Paul is going to Jerusalem, right? Why is he going to Jerusalem? Any ideas? No. There, it's not stated here, but we talked about it before. Why is he going to Jerusalem? Yes, he's picking up absolutely. So he's picking up an offering. Right, and he's going to go to Jerusalem. So that is the whole intent. That's the first thing why he's going. And the second reason, right, was to also go back in those areas is to strengthen the churches that he had just planted. And obviously knows that Jerusalem is the place that he needs to be because God will do something that he is believing he will as far as testifying for the gospel. So let's look at the first part, encouraging and strengthening others, verses 1 through 6. First, he stops at Ephesus, right? We know that he encourages. Look at chapter 20, verse 1. Encourage them, right? That's the word that is used for encouraging, which is the same word as where we get the word Holy Spirit, right? The paraclete or parakaleo, which means just to encourage other people. So he says that he encouraged people in Ephesus, which I like here about Paul. But he continues on. Verses 3 to 6, he's also going to go to Troas. What's not mentioned here is that when he goes from Ephesus, he stops at Troas. And he actually preaches the gospel there. And he sets up a church. He starts another church. And it's not discussed in the book of Acts. He just says he went through that area. Well, where do we find information about that? You can write it down. We're not going to read it. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. So Paul goes to Troas and he starts a new church where he preaches the gospel. He starts a new church. He expects to meet Titus there to bring report from Corinth. Titus is in Corinth. He's right here. Paul had written one letter. He sent it there. Then he's wrote a second letter. And Titus was there when that second letter was delivered, or Titus delivered it. And so Paul wants to meet Titus in Troas to see the report. What happened to that? To the response? What was the response of that second letter, which we don't have? So technically speaking, right? 2 Corinthians is the third letter written to the Corinthians, not the second one. But we don't know what happened to that second letter. So Paul waits for Titus in Troas, expecting a report, but Titus doesn't show up. How do we know that? 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, and also chapter 7, verses 5 through 7. I'll read those two verses just to give you an idea. When I came to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ, the Lord opened a door for me. I had no rest in my spirit because I did not find my brother Titus. But I said goodbye to them and left for Macedonia. So he stopped in Troas, right, preaches the gospel, expects to find Titus. He's not there. He moves on to Macedonia. And that's what we have here in chapter 20, verse 1. Now, he went through those areas. We also think that he also went farther where he's never gone before. It is believed that Paul went all the way to Illyricum. Where is Illyricum in our modern maps today? Is Yugoslavia. It is believed, according to Romans 15:9, that Paul went to Yugoslavia and preached the gospel there too. This is what he says in Romans chapter 15, verse 9. And so that the Gentile may glorify God for his mercy, that's not the correct one. So it's not there. Okay, I lost it. But he goes to Illyricum, and it is in Roman. So Paul even goes further than just Troas. He goes to Illyricum, or what is called modern Yugoslavia, to preach the gospel as well. This happens in that time from verses 1 all the way to verse 2 in chapter 20. How much time has passed? We don't know. But it could have happened that it maybe took a year or two. We don't exactly know how long it took for him to do all that. But now we come to verse 2, where he is in verse 1, he's in Macedonia, right? Encourages the believers there as well. Look at verse 1. And after saying goodbye, departed to go to Macedonia. And when he had passed through those areas and exhorted them, again, the same word there, right? Exhorted, encourage. It's the same word we just looked at. So Paul continues to encourage all these new believers. And then came to Greece, or what we call Corinth. And he spends there three months. But what happens is, in Macedonia, he meets Titus, and Titus brings good reports. Says, hey, the Corinthians responded well to the letter. And so he writes a third letter, which is 2 Corinthians, in our Bibles. And Titus goes on ahead and takes the letter before Paul gets there. And then Paul gets there. And he is there for at least those months. Now, while he's in Corinth, obviously, he's going to minister to them and encourage them as well. And while he's at Corinth, he discovers he's going to go to Syria. He wants to go to Syria, heading towards Jerusalem. He discovers that the Jews are planning to kill him. When are they going to do this? They're going to kill him. They're planning to kill him at sea and discard his body, throw him in the sea. They discover that plot. Yeah. So Paul discovers. Now, why? Why are they planning this Because there, he didn't. He was in Corinth, right? They didn't want to do anything in Corinth publicly. Obviously, they're afraid because it has to be legal. They have to do due process in some ways, and obviously, they're not going to be so open to doing it. But again, they're plotting this to do it at sea because nobody's going to discover this if they do it at sea, right? And so Paul discovers this, and he decides he's not going to go the same way that he would go by sea. He's not going to go from Corinth going this way, as he's done before. He's going to go through Macedonia around it, a little longer path, but he thinks that's a better way to avoid it. That's verse 3. So the plot. Now, in verse 4, look at it. He was accompanied by a bunch of guys, right? So those people represent the different places where churches have been established. Why does Paul take all those people? And actually, verse 5 says they went on ahead and waited in Troas. Why? Why all those people? Those are representatives of the churches he's just planted. And they are actually places where the collections, the offerings have taken place. So Paul is taking those people representing the churches with the offering as well. So when they get to Jerusalem, all these people will show up and say, this is the offering that we bring to you, the mother church, right? They're going to do this. Was Paul bound to do this? Was Paul obligated to pick up an offering? Did anyone tell Paul, pick up an offering and bring it to the churches? No. Paul knew that the church, the mother church of Jerusalem, had been instrumental in this whole process of reaching out to Gentiles. And he's doing this because he wants to recognize the church as the mother church, the church that has allowed him and many others to have the gospel. And he's grateful for that. And he's going to bring an offering for the poor who are in Jerusalem, in the church. And he's going to bring all these people that represent those churches. I think that's kind of a cool thing, isn't it? It's not Paul walking in with an offer. Look what I collected for you. Paul was never that way. He always brought people with him, right? And he's bringing a whole lot of people, right? And they go on ahead. They go to Troas. And it says in verse 5, they went ahead and waited for us in Troas. But we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. In 5 days, we reached them at Troas, where we spent 7 days. So Paul and his team goes on ahead to Troas. Paul decides to linger a little longer. And he says he actually gets to Troas, and they spend 7 days, which brings us to verse 7, worshiping on the Lord's Day. This is the part. Paul just encouraged all these churches around where he's planted them, and now he's coming back to Troas. He's going to spend there a few days, 7 days, and he's going to gather to worship on the Lord's Day. And this is a pretty cool section. I think it's worth reading it. Verse 7, on the first day of the week, which is what? Sunday. This is one of the few times we actually see that the church is actually recognizing Sunday, the Lord's Day. It is when Christ resurrected that is seen as the normal day of meeting as opposed to Saturday, which the Jews have been observing for a long time. So now they come at the first day of the week. We assemble to break bread. This is the Lord's gathering. What are they doing in the Lord's gathering? Breaking bread? Have you seen that before in Acts? Chapter 2, right? They were breaking bread together. What does that mean? We did it today. The Lord's Supper, we did it today, right? See how we connect everything, John? The Lord's Day. So they broke bread. They had this fellowship, right? And Paul says he comes there, and Paul spoke to them. Now, the word spoke here, it's actually to dialogue. That's the verb in Greek, dialogomai, which means to dialogue. That's what we get dialogue. So he's dialoguing, right? But he's also preaching, but he's dialoguing. And since he was about to depart the next day, he extended his message until midnight. Now, why midnight? Did he start early? No, they met in the evening. So the church, remember, Sunday for them was a work day. It was not a free day like we have or off day. They're actually a day of work, so they met in the evening. So they're meeting, right? Paul is going to leave the next day, so Paul has a lot to share to the church, and he extends his message until midnight. There were many lamps in the room upstairs where we assembled, and a young man named Eutychus. The name Eutychus means fortunate. Now, pay attention to that name, fortunate, and how it's connected. It was sitting on a windowsill and sank into a deep sleep as Paul kept on speaking. Okay? As Paul is speaking, he says he falls asleep. When he was overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was picked up dead. But Paul went down, fell on him, embraced him, and said, "Don't be alarmed, for his life is in him." After going upstairs, breaking the bread, and eating, Paul conversed a considerable time until dawn. Then he left. They brought the boy home alive, and were greatly comforted. So first we have the Lord's gathering. Paul gathers together with the church, right, to celebrate the Lord's Supper, right? But not only that, Paul gives the message, the Lord's message, right? We have it here in church. What do? Celebrate the Lord's Supper. What do we do too? Proclaim the word of God. And Paul does that, right? But there's also this dialogue going on, right? Now, he extends his message until midnight. So he goes longer. Now, in America, we have this deal that whenever we have services, they have to be, what, an hour long, right? Or less. And we got to be prompt and finish. I mean, I'm sorry, but Andrew went a little bit, I think, long today and took some of my time. So, gosh, right? And we complain, things like that. But what happens, even in our own Hispanic culture, this doesn't happen. You go to the service, Hispanic services, I'm telling you, I'm not used to this anymore. But we used to go there, and sometimes services lasted, you know, 2 to 3 hours. I mean, they have no, and the sermons just go long, man. They just keep talking and talking and talking. They go long. But in our culture, we are very careful, like, to stick to hours. Well, for them, even in Middle Eastern cultures, time was not the most important thing. It was the event that's more important. And so Paul extends his message until midnight. Who knows how long he's been going? But he is sharing the gospel. He's encouraging others. I wish we could see what he was telling them, right? What was he sharing? I mean, people were... And I give credit to this young man who we don't know how old he was. Some say it is between 7... Here's my range. From 7 years old all the way to 30. We don't know how old he was, but what I find is fascinating is that he's actually listening to Paul, which we don't have nowadays. We have kids who don't even want to listen to it. They can't even listen to a sermon because they're too distracted. By the way, my son could sit now. He sat through the sermon today, and he'll take notes. He'll go back home, and he'll write a short report. This is what I learned. But that's part of his training. His training is to listen, to be able to listen to a sermon, take notes, being able to process that and see what he learned. And this boy is doing that. But what happens? As he's doing that, Paul extends, probably because not only they're tired, right? They probably worked. Notice that some of the candles, or they had some lamps, right? That also produces a sense of being drowsy, gets drowsy. Paul's length, he's probably tired. Who knows what happens, but he falls down a floor. Now, it says third floor. They have 3 floors, but it's probably the second floor. That's how we see it. Instead of the third floor, and he falls down, right? And it's almost very interesting, right? Paul goes down, and what does he do? He lays on them. Does that remind you of any passage in the Old Testament? Who? Elijah and Elisha. They both did that in 1 Kings chapter 17 and 2 Kings chapter 4. He does the same thing. They lay down on people and they just give them their life right back. Well, Paul does that here. He says, hey, don't be alarmed. His life is in him. What he's saying is, don't worry. He's okay. He's just bringing back by the Lord's power. He comes back to life. What I find it fascinating, he goes upstairs, breaks bread, eating, Paul converses. It continues on. He goes out, has this time of fellowship with people. Again, breaking the bread. The Lord's Supper was related to a feast. And they call it agape feast. So they would gather together, eat, right, a supper, and then celebrate the Lord's Supper. This morning as we were doing that, I thought about it. Wouldn't it be cool to have the Lord's Supper in a different way, like the way they did it, and have supper, have lunch together, and then celebrate the Lord's Supper there? Because that's the only way we can understand what happens in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So when you read it, it's not that they were taking little cups of wine and eating, and that's what they got drunk. They actually have this love feast, and they gathered together, and they were all drinking. Well, there were people that were financially very well off, and there are people that weren't financially well off, and all the people that were financially well off came in, took their little, brought their wine, their best stuff, started drinking and eating before everybody got there. So they got all drunk. And so when the time for the Lord's Supper was, it was chaos. Now imagine all these people drunk, drinking and eating. Some were drinking, yeah, bless the Lord, and they're drinking more wine and getting drunk. That's the chaos that was in Corinth. And so Paul has to discipline them, and says the Lord has already disciplined some of you, and you're dead. because you are abusing the Lord's Supper. But the Lord's Supper was in the context of fellowship, in the context of a meal. And this is what Paul is doing, right? After he goes up and picks up this boy, again, he resurrects him pretty much, just like Peter had done as well. He comes back and joins the community, breaks bread, and they eat. Now, what time is it? It's probably around there. You think, wait a minute, eating at this time? Right? For us who like structure, right? It's like, eating? That's crazy. I wouldn't be eating in midnight. That's bad time to eat. You know, then you have to go to bed, and then, you know, the calories that you're going to accumulate, and then you don't do any exercise. Well, that's just the reasoning. That's not the point. The point is the fellowship, right? People are having this fellowship. The Lord's Supper is part of it. They have this time of eating. And then Paul says, converse, right? So not only is he dialoguing, proclaiming the name, now he is, it's a different word here. Converse is to explain, to talk. He's talking with them and sharing again until dawn. So a few more hours, Paul is doing this. But fellowship until dawn. Yeah, of course. So he does that, and there's that fellowship, the Lord's fellowship, and Paul is doing this with people at the church in Troas. Now, verse 12 says they brought the boy home alive and greatly comforted. He seems like he's out of place, but what he's saying is that this event where the Lord's power is manifesting, bringing this boy back to life, brings comfort as well to the people of God, to the church. And so it's very important to see it as part of this whole narrative. Now, let's look at verse 13 through 16. Now, traveling to Miletus. So Paul is in Troas, and we just see how he congregated with the church in Troas. Now he's going to go, where? It says here, when we went ahead to the ship and sailed for Assos. So where is he going? He's going to go this way, and let's see, where is Assos? I don't know if it's somewhere here. He's going to go a road somewhere here. Miletus. Oh, Assos, right there. There's Assos. He's going to go there. And then he's going to head to Miletus. All right? That's where our maps show. Verse 13. Went on ahead to the ship and sailed for Assos, intending to take Paul on board there. For these were his instructions. He himself was going by land. Why is Paul going by land? He's going 20 miles on foot. Paul is traveling. His team is traveling by sea, 20 miles, which is a longer travel. Because to get to where they're going, to Miletus, is going to take longer by ship than going by walking. So Paul decides to go by land. Why is Paul walking 20 miles? We don't know. Huh? Well, there is no, the plot has already been, they couldn't get him. But now Paul is walking. We don't know. We don't know why Paul actually decides to do that. Now, but do you want to know how much Paul is going to walk through his lifetime as a missionary? Okay, he walks 8,700 miles. That's how much Paul walks through his whole 30 years as a missionary. 8,700 miles by foot and 15,000 by sea. Okay, so that's a total of 8,700 miles by foot and about 1,500 miles through sea in the 30 years or so that he's a missionary. That's pretty incredible. He's walking 20 miles to Miletus. And I was like, wow, man. Like, we complain, walk a mile. I don't want to walk a mile. Yeah, I don't want to park far either. Come to church. I don't want to drive 15 minutes to church. Far less, drive 20 miles, right? So Paul travels by land. Now, his team travels by sea. Look at verse 15. Sailing from there the next day, we arrived off Chios. The following day, we crossed over to Samos, and the day after, we came to Miletus. So Miletus, again, they're traveling this area, Assos, and we're going here, and they end up to Miletus. Now, if you look at your map, Ephesus, it's already past the area. So they passed Ephesus, all right? Why is that important? Because Paul, in the next section, Paul is going to address the elders at Ephesus. But the elders at Ephesus are going to come to Miletus. They're going to walk about 30 miles. To come where he is. Why does Paul decide not to stop at Ephesus? Very likely because he's in a hurry. He wants to get to Jerusalem. He cannot waste time. And so he's going to ask him to come, and he's going to speak to them, which is on verse 17 and on. But Paul and his team sailed to Miletus, right? And then they bypass Ephesus. to get to Jerusalem. And from there, he will summon the elders at Ephesus. And next time we have the study in this section, we'll talk about that. This is a very important section, what he tells the elders in Ephesus. But here are a few applications that we can learn from this passage. What are some applications from this passage as we looked at it? Number one, encouragement in the faith comes through worship on the Lord's Day. Encouragement in the faith comes through worship on the Lord's Day through several means. The preached word. Did Paul encourage others through preaching? Yes. Not only the preached word, the Lord's Supper. Are people encouraged through the Lord's Supper? Yes. Through exhortation. Do you think Paul was exhorting people, encouraging them? Yes, and I saw some of you were encouraging others this morning, right? You were sharing hope, right? You were sharing the gospel with people. That is what we're called to do. And I love it when I see that, because that is the whole point of why we're gathered together in the Lord's Day, through exhortations, divine interventions, right? What was the divine intervention in the book of Acts? This boy fell down. Nobody was, this boy fortunate, was really fortunate. That is the whole play here with Luke. This boy is fortunate, right? His name was Fortunate. He probably in all his life, they were probably calling him Fortunate, never realized that his name was Fortunate until he fell down and died, and Paul raised him up from the dead.
That's proof there's no such thing as luck.
Correct, right? And so that's divine intervention. I mean, Paul resurrected this boy, and that was a divine intervention. Paul wasn't planning on it. It's almost kind of funny that he's going long, and because of his fault, he falls down. C.H. Spurgeon used to say, don't fall asleep in the service, because there are no apostles here anymore. So don't fall off a building, right, or somewhere and die, because there are no apostles. Right, that was the whole, his point is, don't fall asleep because, you know, Paul is not here to raise anyone up. But in this case, God arranged that, and that's divine intervention. Are there any divine interventions in our gathering? There should be. And there are in many ways and forms, not just, you know, oh, we're going to resurrect somebody from the dead, but it's how we minister to each other, how God puts us in the place where we minister to people, and people are encouraged by that. So we do it through exhortations, divine interventions, and fellowship. In this case, the meals that they were eating, that's also brought encouragement. I think those are the best ways sometimes to minister to each other when we're enjoying a cup of coffee, right? The best conversation we have in our church is not when we are formally doing something, but it's when we are having a cup of coffee together, we're just chatting and talking back and forth, and we say, hey, the Lord is doing this in our lives, and we're encouraged. Like when we go back home on Sundays, are you not going home encouraged? And you go, wow, man, so-and-so is going, you know, and then you're praying in the afternoon, maybe on Sundays, right, Sunday nights, remembering all those people that you've made contact with on Sunday and praying for them, because you know God put you there to minister to them, right? And so that is what we learn from this passage. Encouragement in the faith comes through all these types of modes. Number two, the Bible is preached, we know this, taught, proclaimed, and I'm using all these verbs on purpose, taught, proclaimed, used for dialoguing, explaining, convincing others of the need of the gospel. Was Paul preaching the gospel where all these believers were? Of course. Because among us, not all of us have come to Christ yet, right? There are many people who walked there who didn't know Christ. Well, there we have that here too. People don't know Christ. I mean, Paul was making sure in any way he could, whether it was preaching the word, whether it was talking to people, dialoguing back and forth, whether it was discussing, trying to convince them, Christ is the answer, right, for you. Christ is the one that can give you hope, that can give you salvation. And that's what we do on Sundays here, right? We proclaim the gospel of Christ to people, telling them there is hope, there is salvation in Christ, there is peace through him. And that's what we do. That's why it's important that when we gather, we preach the gospel to people here, even if it's non-believers or all believers. You know what? There are people who are believers and they're not believers. I've been pastors who've been pastors for a long time. Well, just in the news, I was reading about this guy who was a pastor for about 20 years. And he decided that he was going to try to be an atheist for a year or so. And guess what happened? You would say that this guy came back with his faith strengthened. He came back saying that there's likely that there is no God. And so he decided to become an atheist. He's still deciding. But he's more convinced now that there is no God, so he's decided that he's probably going to be an atheist. Now, this is a guy who preached for 20 years. So are we to tell that there aren't people in our church that come and going to sit there and listen and not believe the gospel? Yes. If God doesn't touch their hearts, no one will, right? We can proclaim, and that's why it's important to continue to proclaim the gospel even to each other and say, Christ has risen. God, Christ, through his death, has given us salvation in Christ, and making sure that we continually preach to us, to ourselves, the gospel, because we need it. And we need to proclaim it. So that is another application. The Bible is preached, taught, proclaimed, used for dialogue and explaining and convincing others of their need of the gospel of Christ. Number three, ministry involves plurality of leaders and co-laborers. When we minister to others, it involves all of us. It should involve. That's why Paul had all these people with him. And that's what I love about Paul. He was never by himself. He was always with someone. And are you not comforted when you're with someone? Yes, you are. When you're sharing the gospel with someone, if somebody's with you, gives you strength. Like my wife's telling you about this coworker that's facing a very hard situation. And God has providentially set it up all that she got there before she probably was dead. And I kept telling her, right, that this was not going to end up well if not, there was no intervention. But there's another believer there, and I'm sure the other believer that's also a good friend of her, and I know them too, but they encourage each other, right, and that helps. Well, encouraging each other and helping this lady and this family come to Christ is a good thing, because we need each other. And so it involves multiple people and even co-laborers helping us to do the work of ministry. And I'm a firm believer that we need others to do the work. We can't do everything. I'm a firm believer that we need each other. And we can only do so much, and we need others to help us as well. Number four, helping the poor in the church is an obligation of the church. Those who have more need to help those who are needy. Now, Paul did this collecting, this offering. I found it interesting, right? He's collecting this offering for the poor in the church. It doesn't mean we don't help people outside the church, but what I found interesting is that Paul is collecting funds from different churches geographically to the church in Jerusalem. He's not collecting an offering for the churches, right, that he's planted. He's collecting for other churches. So in our network, what churches are we helping that are poor, the people that are poor? None. So you say, well, but it's because we don't have churches planted. Well, that's my thought process was, why aren't we connected with those churches? Why aren't we connected geographically with the churches that are around us who preach the gospel? And find out if there are needs. Given, right, we have not planted those churches. Given Paul did plant those churches and they were connected, right? But they're really, some of these people did not know the church in Jerusalem at all. It was just Paul's initiative to take this offering to the poor. And I believe that we as the church have that obligation to help those who are poor, not only in our midst, but around us who are part of the church. And when I mean the church, I mean the whole church, the general church, what we call the general church, or universal church, and help those who are needy, right? We do have people who have needs. So those are the four things that I see that we can bring as an application to us. Hopefully this can be helpful for us as well as we continue to discuss this. And I can tell you that as the more I continue to read the book of Acts, it continues to transform the way of thinking and seeing how we do ministry and how we approach it many times, and how it goes against what we think. And it also allows me to see Paul in a different light. I don't know if you can see how Paul is, just see how Paul is working and doing things. To me, it's such an incredible thing. And now as you read, for example, 1 Corinthians, you know what happened. You read 2 Corinthians. Oh, this was happened when Paul was in where? Where was Paul when he wrote 2 Corinthians? No, we just did it. No, he's where? No, he traveled, right? He already went from Ephesus, he travels, and where he's in Troas, remember? And that's where he writes 2 Corinthians and sends it ahead, because Paul's going to go, he's going to go to Corinth. Now, where does he write Romans? You know where he wrote Romans? In Corinth. So now when you're Romans, you go, oh, he was in Corinth when he wrote Romans. It's incredible. I think Paul had time. He spent a few months there in Corinth, and he's writing to the Romans, 16 chapters that we have nowadays, right? But it's pretty amazing how he's able to do all that for the glory of God. Let's pray.